Hello there. Today's Thursday, November 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the most powerful woman in the U.S. speaks of sadness for the country as a crucial new phase of the presidential impeachment hearings begin.
Prayerful, thoughtful, and actually sad today that our country has to come to a place where the president doesn't understand that Article 2 does not say that he can do whatever he wants.
The hearings came as the president welcomed a controversial world leader to the White House. Also ahead, People names it Sexiest Man Alive. It's all on today's International Edition.
Committee will come to order.
The top U.S. diplomat in Ukraine in the first public hearing of the impeachment inquiry against President Donald Trump went on Wednesday and linked the president more directly to a pressure campaign on Ukraine to conduct investigations that would benefit him politically. Deputy Secretary of State George Kent and career diplomat William Taylor testified before the House Intelligence Committee about their concerns about pressure by Trump and allies to get Ukraine to investigate Democratic political rival Joe Biden in a dramatic hearing that pitted Democratic and Republican lawmakers against each other. Here's Taylor.
He began that, again, by repeating, this is not a quid pro quo, but if President Zelensky did not clear things up in public, we would be at a stalemate. And what I understood in that meeting, the meaning of stalemate was the security assistance would not come.
That was Taylor speaking of a member of his staff overhearing the July 26th phone call between President Trump and Ambassador Gordon Sondland, the Trump-appointed ambassador to the U.N. who was instructed to lead the effort. Trump played down the hearing as he weighed in during a press conference with the visiting president of Turkey.
I see they're using lawyers that are television lawyers. They took some guys off television. You know, I'm not surprised to see it because Schiff can't do his own questions.
Earlier, I spoke with VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson about the beginning of this new phase in the impeachment inquiry. Catherine, did Democrats achieve their goal so far in making the case to the American people?
I think Chairman Adam Schiff in his opening statement did a really good job of separating himself from some of the partisan dialogue we've been seeing in Washington these past few weeks since that whistleblower complaint came out. Whether he was able to convince the American people that President Trump should be impeached, that's a different story. You know, when we recover stories, we look for that one moment that leaps out, that everyone will remember, that people who don't cover this for a living will sit back and say, yes, this is what happened today. I'm not sure that that moment happened for Democrats. They wanted to have this open and shut case that President Trump abused the power of his office. They're going to have to do a little bit of hard work in these upcoming witness hearings to make that happen.
Do you think that Republicans did what they wanted to do, which was to sort of cast doubt on the whole situation, on the whole investigation?
Look, I think when it comes down to it, nobody's minds are really going to be shifted significantly. The president has a very strong base in this country, as we all know, this 30-35% of voters that will stay with him no matter what. Those people, their minds are definitely not going to be changed. Whether or not this shifts independence, whether they take the time to look at what is really a very complicated series of events with a lot of moving parts involving what is normal in U.S. foreign policy and what is abnormal, that's another question that remains to be answered.
You say it's complicated, but in some ways it sounded in the beginning from House Speaker Nancy Pelosi that this was actually a lot less complicated than the whole Mueller or Russia investigation because it was pretty cut and dry. The president asked a foreign leader, or allegedly asked a foreign leader, for help with investigating a political rival in exchange for money that was allocated and approved by Congress for military support. Does it have to be complicated, or are they not doing a good enough job of uncomplicating it and making it pretty simple?
Well, you've seen a shift from House Democrats in the past week or so where they've moved away from the phrase quid pro quo, which requires a little bit of explanation, to this idea that the president committed bribery. Clear and simple, that's what happened in his dealings with Ukraine. And of course, as we know, that's one of the three elements laid out in the U.S. Constitution that is the standard for impeaching a U.S. president. Bribery, treason, high crimes and misdemeanors.
Politically, did this hurt the president at all?
I think it's too soon to tell until we hear from the full spectrum of the witnesses that House Democrats have been listening to behind closed doors for the past few weeks. In speaking of them the past few weeks, I know that they consider what Trump did an impeachable offense. But remember, they've heard from all of the witnesses. The American people and the journalists on Capitol Hill have not yet.
And the Republicans continue to say that this has not been a fair process, that there were people they wanted to bring in as witnesses, like Joe Biden's son Hunter and like this anonymous whistleblower. Are they justified, or is this a political ploy to just make it look like the Democrats are being unfair?
Well, the Democrats would argue that we've gone far beyond the whistleblower complaint, and so there's really no reason to bring the whistleblower in. You already have several witnesses who are testifying next week who were firsthand witnesses to that July 25th phone call between Trump and the Ukrainian president. So in a sense, you're really not using the whistleblower in any meaningful way if you already have those witnesses telling you about the content of the phone call. For the Hunter Biden issue, that's really a matter of how you see politics. Schiff wrote this letter that said, we're not going to be bringing Hunter Biden in. That is not the issue at hand. The issue at hand is whether the president abused his office. But for Republicans, the argument is that that's intricately tied in with why President Trump acted this way, that he was trying to address corruption, that he was very concerned about how Ukraine was using aid. They want to have those answers from Hunter Biden.
All right. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. And now for more on the legal implications of what this could mean for the crucial new phase that threatens President Trump's very presidency as he seeks re-election in 2020, we are joined live by criminal defense attorney Jack Rice in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Jack, thanks for being with us.
Great to be with you.
All right. So how, first of all, did the attorneys do on both sides? Who they did most of the questioning in the Democratic and Republican side, which was probably better. But how did they do?
Well, looking at specifically Daniel Goldman first, again, the House Intelligence Committee for the majority, I thought he did a great job. I mean, the challenge is this, is you have to contemplate just how much information they have. It's thousands and thousands and thousands of pages. It's also multiple interviews already, interrogations on the front end of this thing, and to try to boil that down into something that's cogent, something that people will understand. It's something he did very, very well. Now, honestly, on the other hand, Steve Castor, he's the minority counsel. When I listened to him, I was kind of shocked by his cross, because one of the things that I do when I'm teaching cross-examination is your questions are very specifically tailored, very narrow. And his were broad-based, very sweeping, sometimes hard to follow, but it really shows that what the Republicans, what the GOP is trying to do right now is not just cross-examine the person that's in front of them. They're trying to create a narrative, a statement that they push out across the country, because they're trying to grab enough people to say that what happened wasn't that big a deal.
All right. Well, it was, as Catherine said, the impeachment of a president can be for three things: bribery, treason, high crimes and misdemeanors. Do any of those accusations brought against the president so far fall within this? And do you see that they've got the goods? Do they have enough evidence to vote to impeach?
Well, at this point, obviously, they're still rolling it out. So that's obviously the question. But if we look at what we had right now and what I saw from Ambassador Taylor, what I saw from George Kent was impressive. These are pros. These are people for their careers. This is what they have done. And they came across as very balanced, very fair, not cagey at all. And I think that cut against the Republicans, certainly cut against the president, because especially Ambassador Taylor laying out exactly what he understood, what he heard, and it seemed very clear that what he saw, what he heard, what he was concerned about was a president who was essentially extorting a president of Ukraine to do very specific things to help him with his presidential campaign. And that's something that no sitting president can do. So, yes, this is a problem for the president.
Well, there was also an important revelation that came out that we hadn't heard before from Taylor, acting ambassador to Ukraine. He pointed to the Republican president's keen interest in getting Ukraine, obviously, to investigate Biden. And listen to what Taylor said.
The member of my staff could hear President Trump on the phone asking Ambassador Sondland about the investigations. Ambassador Sondland told President Trump the Ukrainians were ready to move forward.
We had not heard before a direct link to the president like that, where we actually hear the president was asking how the investigation was going. How potentially damaging for the president was that?
This could be actually huge. I expect that this will come back again and again with the majority. They're going to continue to hit on this. The one part that you didn't have in there was the part that talked about the president's interest was in Biden, not in Ukraine. And that really cuts against this question of the president looking at the issue of corruption in general in Ukraine, when in fact what he was doing was looking at Joe Biden. And that makes this much different. This is a narrative that I think was just taken away from the Republicans.
And we understand that that person, that staffer of Taylor's, will be now testifying at some point. So that could add more intrigue.
Oh, no question about it. I mean, one of the things that we did see today that was interesting was Congressman Jordan actually came out and tried to make this argument that Ambassador Taylor, being, quote unquote, the star witness, was so far away from this. But we have to remember that Congressman Schiff, the chairman of the Intelligence Committee, he's a former federal prosecutor, and he knows how to put on a case. And part of what he's doing is he's creating a foundation with the likes of Ambassador Taylor and Assistant Secretary George Kent. And then what he's going to do is start filling in the gaps and get this closer and closer to the epicenter until finally it's right on top of the president. And that's what he's trying to do. And so far, I think he's doing it quite well.
Well, so we know it's a political trial, but it is being handled like as if it were a criminal trial. If it were in a criminal court, what, as a criminal defense attorney, what would be the standard for guilt? Would this look bad as well in a court of law?
It could. If we're in a criminal court, they would have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the president were guilty. But if you notice, a lot of the evidence doesn't really apply. When we had the ambassador say, well, I was told this by one of my underlings, by somebody else, that would generally not come in as hearsay anyway. And so you're having more sweeping approach here. But actually, that can hurt the president, because what you get is a more cohesive story with the ability of Ambassador Taylor to lay out a long narrative that's not just what he knows, but what he was told and what he understood, and in such a way that the American people understand it. That's what's going to be compelling, not just for the House, but certainly once this gets to the Senate.
All right. Well, we know once it gets to the Senate, that will be a much tougher sell. It's the Republicans that have the majority to make a decision whether to actually go forward and remove the president of the United States. That could be a higher hurdle to overcome. And ultimately, what would that say if the president was not removed? He would probably come out, I would imagine, calling it a vindication. Would that ultimately set a new precedent for what presidents can and cannot do?
Yeah, this is horrifying. And not just as a former prosecutor thinking about this, as a former Central Intelligence Agency case officer looking at what we have here. If we have a sitting president who has the ability to reach out to foreign governments and say, I want you to go after my political adversaries in the United States, and that's okay, it changes everything. This is something that would never have been acceptable by either party, I mean ever. And to say that that's not an impeachable offense is astounding. Now, obviously, it has to be proven. There is a standard that has to be met. But to say that if it is proven and it doesn't matter, that puts us in a completely, completely different environment.
All right. That is criminal defense attorney and former Central Intelligence Agency officer Jack Rice. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here are some of the stories we're following at VOAnews.com. North Korea says it is out of patience when it comes to Washington. The U.S. says it plans to reevaluate its relationship with South Sudan. A car bomb has killed 12 people in the Afghan capital of Kabul. And Lebanese protesters are back in the streets with major highways blocked. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. U.S. President Donald Trump Wednesday lauded his relationship with Turkish President Tayyip Erdogan as the leaders met in Washington to overcome mounting differences between the two NATO allies, ranging from Syria policy to Turkey's purchase of a Russian missile defense system. AP correspondent Jennifer King reports.
While impeachment hearings were underway on Capitol Hill, President Trump hosted Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and his wife at the White House.
I'm a big fan of the president.
And he seemed determined not to let the hearings or the recent incursion into northern Syria get in the way of good relations with the NATO ally.
We're having a very strong discussion on different things, including the safe zone and the border, the oil, and again, trade is a very big factor.
A handful of GOP senators invited to the Oval Office expressed their concerns about the fate of Kurdish allies and Turkey's warming relations with Russia, including the purchase of a Russian air defense system. Among them was Texas Senator Ted Cruz.
We very much hope Turkey changes the path it's on and does not employ the S-400.
Trump says he thinks their differences can be resolved. Jennifer King, Washington.
The U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services naturalized 833,000 people, an 11-year high in new oaths of citizenship in fiscal year 2019, which ended September 30th. This fiscal year, the USCIS administered the Oath of Allegiance to 60 of America's newest citizens from 51 countries during a special naturalization ceremony Tuesday at the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian. Sadiq Ulas Islam talked to some of the new citizens about how they feel and what they're looking forward to as new U.S. citizens.
Holding American flags in their left hands, the group raised their right hands and placed them over their hearts and took the oath of allegiance to the United States of America.
It means a lot. It means that I get to join one of the world's greatest countries of all times, be able to serve this country.
For these 60 people from 51 different countries, young and old, this was the final step to become a naturalized citizen of the United States of America. But it also marked a new beginning in their lives.
It's going to open more doors for me as a young guy growing up.
Yeah, I found it very emotional. I feel that it is a privilege that not very many people can obtain.
Becoming a U.S. citizen bestows many privileges, including being able to bring family members to the U.S., as well as being eligible for federal jobs and run for public offices. But in this crowd, many were excited to be able to vote in upcoming presidential elections.
I got the citizenship here, and the most exciting part of this one thing is that the next year is going to be vote, and I will vote. Yeah.
I am very interested in being able to vote.
While the Trump administration has proposed major cuts to legal and family immigration and capped the number of refugees to the U.S. in the year 2020 at 18,000, USCIS, the government agency that oversees lawful immigration to the United States, naturalized 833,000 people in the fiscal year of 2019 in new oaths of citizenship, an 11-year high. Sarah Taylor, acting director of the Washington District, says one reason for the increase in naturalization might be the upcoming election.
So we did have a big uptick always before a presidential election. It stayed high. The interest in naturalization has stayed high over the last couple of years. And we anticipate it will remain high.
Coming from such countries as Afghanistan and Yemen, these new citizens are hopeful for a bright future for themselves and their families. As they said, naturalization will open new doors for them in this land of opportunities.
One nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Saqibul Islam, VOA News, Washington.
Swedish climate Activist teen Greta Thunberg is sailing the Atlantic again with hopes of returning home for the holidays. AP correspondent Ed Donahue reports.
Thunberg left Hampton, Virginia after traveling across North America to warn about global warming.
I'm not judging anyone else. I'm not telling anyone else what to do or what not to do. This I'm doing because I want to do it myself.
Her message?
I want to put focus on the fact that you basically can't live sustainable today.
Thunberg says some people in power simply lack a sense of urgency when it comes to global warming. She agrees with those who say she is too young to be doing this.
It should be the adults who take that responsibility, but it feels like the adults and the people in power today are not.
The boat taking Thunberg across the Atlantic leaves little or no carbon footprint. I'm Ed Donahue.
And you're listening to International Edition. Back in a minute.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. Bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, a new just released survey provides a window into what social causes young Americans between 18 and 30 care most about and what motivates them to act to support those causes. There are some interesting findings that indicate a shift in their attitudes and perspectives that could influence young people's participation in the upcoming 2020 presidential election. Joining us to talk about it is Derek Feldman, founder of Influence Nation. Thanks for being with us. So your organization's research has turned up some interesting things about this new generation of potential voters. Tell us what you learned.
So there were a couple key things. Obviously, we were able to look at the top social issues, the top social movements, and see if there's any differences between our oldest Gen Z generation as well as our youngest millennials, and also some interesting differences between women and men. Specifically, when we look at young Americans primarily in those movements that are about the same, climate change is one of the top ones. Very similar interest in the social issues and the movements around there. But when it comes to gender, we had differences when it came to the movements of interest related to Me Too and Women's March. We had more women obviously interested than we did men. And we note that in the report and think that that's something that we obviously need to look at some of those movements and why there isn't that much of an interest in participation by men.
Is that something that's been a trend that women generally have always been sort of more activism driven, or is this different?
Well, I think given the times of where we are right now and the marches, rallies, conversations that we're having in culture today, it may have been between the two.
There are a lot of topics that obviously these people are concerned about. They're facing a lot of things that they're going to need to be tackling in the years to come.
What's quite intriguing, I think, when you look at a lot of these social issues, some of these are personal, they're global issues as well. And as we looked at kind of where they are going to take the most action, voting, and given that we have an election coming up, we asked them, what are the things that you think are going to actually make a difference and how you can address these issues? Voting is the number one. And we had a whole list of things from things like volunteering or giving money, spending time, marches, rallies. And although some of those were higher, voting was the number one thing. The only place where we saw voting not be the number one leading thing where they want to see change happen and where their actions they think will make a difference is in mental health. In mental health specifically, it was around conversations among family and friends and peers. A lot of these other issues that you brought up, voting is the number one way they see that things are going to change, and that's what they got to exercise that right to vote here and that opportunity to vote in 2020.
That's fascinating because history hasn't shown that young people really have been too active when it comes to voting. voting. It's always been something candidates have tried to get more young people to vote, but so to see that shift could really change dynamics quite a bit as far as what we see in turnout.
Yeah, if you look at turnout in America right now, you're looking at, what, 60% kind of nationwide. Young people, though, came out in 2018. We had the largest, our 2018 midterm election, the largest participation by that generation, by the youngest generation in the country. If you look at the research right now, what's interesting is not just on the civic duty part of this. We wanted to ask how they view voting when it comes to these social issues, and they look at it as a form of social activism, not just civic duty. So I think that we live in an interesting time where we see participation higher with young people from the 2018 midterm election. People in our study are talking about how voting is going to be the way that that change is going to happen on some of these social issues, and they see voting as not just a civic duty, but social activism.
That's very interesting, given this likely to be a very heated campaign, can we say? There are a lot of young people taking to the streets now that are not happy. And I know that during those huge climate protests, they were also out there registering their fellow students to vote that were old enough.
Absolutely. And you know what else, Lori, that's quite interesting? If we stay on the presidential election piece, this is the first time we started to ask questions around fake news, quote unquote fake news, mm-hmm. that we often hear about, whether either way. What we wanted to know, as it relates to young people, specifically, does it exist? And then not only does it exist, but do you think it's going to influence viewpoints of your fellow peers and others when it comes to these big social issues you've talked about? And this is what we heard. They believe it exists. 77% of people in our panel believe that fake news is out there. And it's also going to influence the upcoming election as well. So I think it's an interesting time. They see voting, right? Fake news is out there, social platforms and so forth. It's also influencing the way people view these social issues. Not only do they see it exist, but when you make the connection to voting, some people will be voting based upon what they see on these issues and hear some of these platforms as well. So it'll be an interesting election.
I wonder how that will impact their own judgments. If they're already aware that there is fake news out there, they're not going to just necessarily blindly trust everything they read or every source they go to. It sounds like they're just more in tune to the realities of what the challenges are. Even in a democracy where we shouldn't be seeing fake news out there, but this is a whole new concept that we're dealing with now.
Yeah, and you brought up a really good word in that piece, and that's around trust. And actually, one of the things we discovered in this piece is around trust, and who do young Americans trust the most? And what's interesting is social causes themselves, the organizations, the nonprofits, the NGOs out there fighting for some, and the movement, as compared to corporations who are last, and local government was right after that versus federal government in the United States. So that trust factor will play an important piece. And the causes and organizations, according to our panel that we see here, is the most trustworthy.
All right. That's Derek Feldman, founder of Influence Nation. We will see what happens in the next election with the young people. Taylor Swift's latest hit has been remixed as a duet. Shawn Mendes joined the pop star on the single of her latest album, Lover. It's an honor for Mendes, who is a huge Swift fan, so much so that he even wrote a tribute to Taylor in April as part of her own inclusion in Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People list. And in it, he wrote that what makes Taylor Swift so special is her belief in magic and love, and her ability to be honest and raw, as raw as possible. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Calvin Fowler. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day. Lover. We could light a bunch of candles and dance around the kitchen, baby. Pictures of when we were young could hang on the wall. We'll sit on the stoop, I'll sing love songs to you when we're 80. See, I finally got you now, honey. I won't let you.
fall.